Hello and welcome to the Wild Heart Meditation Center podcast. We release these episodes every week on Wednesday mornings, and the best way to support us is by clicking subscribe and taking a moment to rate the podcast wherever you are listening. If you'd like to support our efforts to keep the nonprofit Meditation Center open in Nashville, you can donate via Venmo by sending your donation to @WildHeartNashville, or you can make a donation through our website, wildheartmeditationcenter.org, by clicking the Donate tab. And one final announcement, we are very excited to offer the Wild Heart Labor Day Weekend Loving Kindness Retreat at Heartwood Refuge in Hendersonville, North Carolina, on September 3rd through the 6th. If you'd like more information about this retreat, please visit wildheartmeditationcenter.org and click the Events tab, or you can sign up and learn more at heartwoodrefuge.org. Peace and love. Hope you enjoy.
All right, so we'll jump into the topic today so we have a little bit of time to discuss together. I know there are a lot of folks that are new to Wild Heart, so welcome. This morning group is co-taught by myself and a dear friend of mine, Rachel Tanner-Smith, who's also the co-director and one of the teachers here. And we alternate weeks teaching together. And we decided when we opened back up for COVID that we'd tackle a topic together called the paramis, This is kind of the Megatron of Buddhist lists. It's got 10 things, 10 kind of principles. Sometimes the paramis are defined as the 10 perfections, right? But we know how we all are with lists and being perfect, right? It's kind of misleading. So Sylvia Boorstein calls it the perfections of the heart. But if you look at the etymology of this word parami, it means something like of utmost importance. So these are the 10 things that are of utmost importance in the Buddha's teaching. So I like to call them the 10 priorities or the 10 spiritual principles. If you were to take all of these lists, all of these teachings that the Buddha taught and kind of maybe boil them down to the core tenets, I think you would find these 10 paramis. And it's said in the mythology of the Buddha's life that it took him hundreds of thousands of eons and 4 kalpas, whatever that is, to perfect these qualities, right? So we've got a lot of time, you know, to try to make this perfect. But these are really core and fundamental aspects of his teaching, but also of what brings us more genuine and sustainable happiness in life. I think as I read them, you'll find that they're not that far-fetched, right? So to go over them, they're on the board. You can follow along. The first is generosity. Then ethical conduct or integrity, living with integrity. The third is renunciation. And then wisdom or insight. And then energy or effort. Patience. Truthfulness, resolve or determination, kindness or goodwill, and equanimity. And so I feel like these are all things most of us could get behind, right? They're not kind of dogmatic beliefs. It's not really a list of commandment that we need to follow. They're kind of guiding principles for our search for more genuine happiness, more peace in our life. Things to live by, priorities. So today I'm offering a talk. I'm a little hesitant to say this, but it's a kind of a widely unpopular topic. And it's on the third of the paramis, which is renunciation. Renunciation can sometimes feel like the talk of like, oh, okay, this is where he's going to talk about like the things I have to let go of or give up that I really like doing, but that probably aren't serving my happiness, you know, that aren't ultimately supporting me in my search for more peace and more happiness in life. These are sometimes our habits that we become dependent on, that in and of themselves sometimes aren't bad things, but they become kind of these rote habits that, yeah, cause this dependence, and then we get caught in the momentum of our habits, and then we're not so happy. I like to say that the definition of renunciation is the willingness to give up and let go of pursuing happiness outside of ourselves. That's all that it is. It's kind of trying to align ourselves with this view that's central to the Buddhist teaching that genuine happiness, sustainable happiness, does not come from what we get from the world. There's a level of pleasure, there's a level of satisfaction, there's a level of gratification that we can get from the world, for sure. But that our genuine, our deeper sense of happiness, sustainable happiness, doesn't come from what we get from the world. It comes from how we meet the world. It comes from how we learn to see clearly and respond wisely to the world, to life on life's terms as it shows up. So our happiness is more about a responsiveness to life. It's not about getting things to our liking. And so it's tricky because in one sense, getting things to our liking isn't all that bad. Having preferences, we all have desires and things that we prefer. But we also all very much know that when we go around chasing our preferences, we cause a lot of unhappiness. When we're seeking instant gratification and the pleasure or the comfort of temporary things, and we don't even mean to put all this stake, we don't even mean to put these things on pedestals and chase them, but we end up doing it, and then we're not happy, ultimately. So this means sometimes letting go of a lesser pleasure or a lesser form of happiness for a higher happiness. You can see why it's an unpopular topic. Sharon Salzberg says, we can travel a long way and do many different things, but our deepest happiness is not born from accumulating new experiences. It is born from letting go of what is unnecessary and knowing ourselves to always be at home. True happiness may not be all that far away, but it requires a radical change of view as to where to find it. I really do feel that the Buddhist teaching is quite radical. You know, this style of happiness that he's teaching is one that's very countercultural and always has been. And there's not one person that we can point our finger at and say, oh, that's to blame, or this person's to blame, or for the reason why we try to chase satisfaction and things outside of ourselves. I think it's just kind of the nature of where we get confused and where we get misguided in our path. The mind always seems to think that our happiness will be right around the corner in the next thing, the next experience. My mind still does it all the time. It tricks me maybe a little bit less than it used to. Right? We bought a house in December, and I was convinced that the new neighborhood and the new experience was going to make me so much happier. Like, I'm going to be friendly with my neighbors, you know, we're going to go out and have coffee together. And then I moved in and I was like, yeah, I'm still here, right? You know that phrase, wherever you go, there you are. And so, yeah, it's this kind of subtle trick that the mind plays sometimes, trying to find our happiness out there. And that is quite radical to try to disrupt that, you know. And what Sharon Salzberg says, I think, is really true, is to try to know ourselves to always be at home, that we're always just in this moment all the time. You know, and this moment is always changing, sure, but our reference point can be the here and now, rather than once I get, or if only I had, or if I had this, then that. So the Buddha's discovery was that the world of our human nervous system is pervaded by an inherent vulnerability. Being human is inherently vulnerable, is kind of the first noble truth. Have you noticed that there's pleasure and pain, that the body grows old, that it becomes ill, that sometimes we get what we want and sometimes we get what we don't want, that we can't have lasting, permanent satisfaction in the world because everything changes. It's pervaded by impermanence. We can know this intellectually, but to experientially try to cope with that, that's hard. To be in our vulnerability that we don't know what the future is going to bring. You know, and what was it, Mark Twain that said, the worst moments in my life never came true, right? So many of the things we do that we suffer about are just trying to predict and prepare ourselves because of the inherent vulnerability, because we don't know. And so the Buddha was on to this, and he said, yeah, you can't find your happiness out there, because out there is impermanent. Out there is always changing. If you put your happiness in impermanent things, your happiness is impermanent. So, what do we do about that? Well, when we're not conscious of this, you know, we try to find satisfaction and comfort temporarily. We even unconsciously kind of compulsively follow whatever is here and now to try to escape our vulnerability. You know, as Blaise Pascal said, that most of our human suffering comes from the fact that we can't sit quietly in a room by ourselves. You know, what is that feeling that we get when we sit with ourselves? That's that vulnerability, that feeling of dis-ease, the dis-ease of the human nervous system that Melvin Connor, the neuroscientist, even studied, right? That chronic internal mixture of anxiety and desire, just that feeling of the default mode network of our brain wanting something. Not even knowing what it is yet sometimes. It's just, I want something. That inherent vulnerability. Not ever able to rest peacefully in the impermanence of life. So that's what our meditation practice becomes about. It's about embracing and opening to the flow of what's here right now. Over and over again, opening our heart. Undefending ourselves, stop trying to fix, manage, and control our way through lives, and try to let go of the control, and just to show up in this moment. Easier said than done, right? So our happiness is fleeting because we seek gratification in impermanent experiences, pleasant sights and sounds and smells and tastes and feelings and thoughts. Experiences, pleasant relationships, pleasant moments of validation, admiration, acknowledgement, pleasant self-identity, the one that I need to be, the one that I want to be. But all those experiences are temporary and they don't last. They only last as long as the praise and validation are there. They only last as long as the experience lasts. And then we have to look for the next one. The Buddha says in a teaching called The Gratification, the Danger, and the Escape, he says that whatever joy and happiness there is in the world, that is the gratification in the world. But that the world is impermanent, pervaded by stress, subject to change, that is the danger in the world. The removal and abandoning of craving and clinging for your happiness in the world, that is the escape from the world. Now, we need to clarify something. There's a difference between craving and clinging after the world and just having desire. There's a difference between desire and craving. Craving is relatively reflexive. It's relatively impulsive and compulsive. It's that drive, that kind of feverish longing for something to help me feel at ease. It's that kind of escapism or that resistance or that avoidance or that type of those habits that get us in that place. Desire in the Buddhist psychology is an ethically neutral mental factor, which means that it doesn't have any inherent destructiveness or constructiveness to it. Desire is just neutral, is what the Buddha is saying. It can lean in either direction. But craving is not a choice, really. It's kind of a reflex. It's a desire to pull something in and to feed on it. And we felt this in moments, right? You feel that kind of emotional need. Ajahn Sachito says that this craving is a desire that's never satisfied because it just shifts from one need to the next and from one sense of achievement to another sense of achievement, another goal. It's a type of desire that comes from a black hole of need, however small and manageable that need is. And so an important part of the Buddha's teaching, hopefully we'll take a breath of fresh air after this, is that the Buddha is saying that two things about craving. He's saying one is that It's repetitive. So he's saying it's some heavy shit to be trying to deal with because it's incessant, it's repetitive, it's insidious. And he also says, totally not your fault. Totally not your fault. He says, the kind of biological drive of the human nervous system. It just is what we are with, craving. So we don't have to get caught in shaming or judging ourselves for wanting to escape feelings of discomfort and dis-ease by temporarily finding gratification in people, places, and things. It's not our fault that that is the case, but it is our responsibility. Our happiness depends on it. And not in some metaphysical sense, but in some very real, practical sense, that our happiness really depends upon our ability to stop escaping ourselves to find happiness. You know, our happiness really depends on our ability to sit with ourselves, to open to what we're experiencing with wisdom and compassion, to try to investigate and discern, why is it that I want to text my ex tonight? What is the feeling I'm trying to avoid right now? You know what I mean? Like, why is it that I feel like I need to go drink that fourth beer right now? You know, like, what is the feeling that I'm trying to escape right now? So it's discernment that heals, not judgment. Judgment is taking it personally and saying, I'm such a shit person. Junkie, addict, chronically in toxic relationships. Because you see, when we criticize ourselves like this, it's also selfish. How are we so unique that we're the only people that suffer? You know, how are we so unique that we're the only ones that have tried to escape our feelings? Some of us for years, sometimes very destructively. You know, for me, drug and alcohol addiction for years in my life. But you know what? That was the best solution I had at the time to try to get through life. The only thing that was keeping me living. And at some point, I had, you know, gratefully people in my life that said, hey man, it doesn't have to be this way. They didn't judge me or shame me, but they said very clearly, like, you are causing your own suffering. It's not your fault that you're in pain, but it's your responsibility. And you got to do something about it because your happiness depends on it. And you can do it. I believe this is kind of the message that the Buddha gives us, is that it's the third noble truth, that freedom's possible. We've experienced it. We have healed and changed and grown from destructive habits, right? And this is what we mean by awakening in Buddhism. It's not some magical moment at the end of a long road. It's about literally seeing those places and times where we have become so dependent on our habits that have caused so much stress and suffering, that where we can change and grow. We can remove ourselves. We can get out. So mindfulness is about awareness. But awareness isn't always good news. You know, this is why I think this teaching on renunciation is radical. This is what kind of changes this Buddhist meditation of mindfulness from secular mindfulness a little bit. It's like, you know, you're sitting down, sure, you're focusing on your breath, you get a little bit of space from your thoughts. That's great. But then you've got to start to really use mindfulness throughout your day to look at where you get hooked in and pulled into things that are causing us to suffer. That's the rest of the Buddhist path, you know? Like, Ajahn Chah says, let go a little, you get a little freedom. Let go a lot, you get a lot of freedom. Let go completely, you get complete freedom. So I really want to read this. I think it's so important when talking about renunciation. Bhikkhu Bodhi says, the problem arises of how do we break the shackles of craving? The Buddha does not offer as a solution the method of repression, which is the attempt to drive away our desire with a mind full of fear and loathing. This approach does not resolve the problem, but only pushes it below the surface where it continues to thrive. The tool that the Buddha holds out to free the mind from craving is understanding. Real renunciation is not a matter of compelling ourselves to give up things still inwardly cherished. but of changing our perspective on them so that they no longer bind us. When we understand the nature of our craving, when we investigate it closely with keen attention, the craving falls away by itself without the need for struggle. So this is really key. He's saying that what we're not doing is attempting to drive away our craving and our desire and our habits with fear and self-loathing, with repression. When we try to hate ourselves into being better people, all that repressed hatred shows up in a lot of fucked up ways in our lives. Depression, reactivity, anger, rage, isolation, all of these really challenging experiences. We're not trying to drive away our craving with repression. He's saying, but that the tool that we use to free our mind from craving is understanding, to actually be really curious, to slow down enough to watch ourselves and our habits with compassionate awareness. Oh, what is this about right now, Andrew? What am I afraid I would have to feel if I didn't do that right now? To understand that the habit that we're continuing to perpetuate in our lives is serving a short-term solution. It's just trying to protect us. It's just trying to help ease our pain, but only can do so temporarily. That type of understanding means we can have compassion for the habits that are causing us to suffer. We can say, oh, I'm doing this because there's loneliness, there's fear, there's all of the things, right? Understanding is the core principle behind renunciation. This is hard also for us Westerners, you know, people that were maybe raised in this kind of like legalist ethics, right? Both in our courts and a lot of our religious upbringing is like, here's the list of rules, follow them, and you don't get in trouble. Right, and Buddhism really strays quite dramatically from that type of approach. You know, it's not this linear list of rules. It's these reflecting on our values and our integrity in each moment. It's being radically honest with ourselves about what's leading to our welfare and happiness and what's leading to the welfare and happiness of other beings. You know, and that's a more challenging practice. Sometimes I wish someone would just tell me what to do. You know, I used to call my meditation teacher and be like, what should I do? He's like, I'm not going to tell you. Feel it in your body, what comes up? Oh, fear and rage and regret and all of these things. Okay, be with that. Breathe with that. Open to that. Sit with that. Right? The word for courage, the etymology of that word is the seed of feelings. It literally means sit with that shit. Like the Latin root of the word courage is sit with that shit. That takes courage to sit with it and to not know, right? You know, like it's confusing. I just sometimes want to know, like what should I do? But then I give my power to other people and then I don't take responsibility in some weird way. You know what I mean? So we have to realize we're all ultimately responsible for what we do, and we're not required to do things perfectly, but we're required to continue looking for the purpose of understanding. So three criteria that I found to be helpful around practicing renunciation. I like to ask myself these three questions. They help me to kind of get more understanding. The first is, does this take me out of the present moment? Is what I'm doing take me out of the present moment? It's really interesting reflection. I gave up drinking coffee for a couple months just because I got really tweaked out on it during COVID. I guess to deal with depression, I was just like, I feel fine, you know, like drinking a whole pot of coffee at the beginning of the day. And it became a problem because I was just crashing so hard. And I was really curious. It's like, getting these cravings for caffeine after a couple weeks. And this is always how I get back into these habits, is I'm like, oh man, like that, I could quit whenever I want. And I was getting these cravings and I was just interested. I was like, oh, I don't want to be in this mind and body as it is right now. Like, I want something to take me out of this experience. I want something that's going to give me energy, that's going to give me this false, like, enthusiasm. Again, I'm not judging people drinking caffeine. My relationship to it was that I wanted to use it to feel better. And it was taking me out of the present moment. So here's a helpful thing with renunciation is it's not about the thing, it's about your relationship to the thing. So this helps us get out of that legalist morality thing that's still deeply conditioned in my mind. You know, like my fellow vegan and vegetarian Buddhists, I'm not a vegan and vegetarian Buddhist. I'm like, man, I should, and you know, all this stuff. And it's like, all right, what's my relationship to, let's at least be honest about the harm that I'm maybe causing by eating meat. You know, it sucks to admit it. I don't like admitting that. Yeah, but it's true, and I eat meat. So let's look at my relationship to it. You know, let's really investigate that. I don't want to, but that's kind of the point. It's why it's radical, this path. So understanding is the core principle behind renunciation. One way we can understand is what I'm doing take me out of the present moment? That's a good kind of question. Another one is, do we lose a sense of freedom? Does this habit, is it causing some type of dependence? Is there a dependence? Dependence is an interesting thing to look at because most of the time our rationalizing mind will say, no way. I'm not dependent on the caffeine. I just throw a fit if I can't have it. You know, I'm not dependent on being in a relationship, but I just feel wildly uncomfortable with myself and who I am when I'm not in one. Right? So some of it is like, we have to kind of own that we're dependent on a lot of things, you know? We do use a lot of things to try to feel better, even if they're not happening in our lives right now. We're like, when's it going to happen? When's it going to happen? And so looking at, you know, is there some type of habit or dependence? Am I losing some sense of freedom in that dependence? And this is an interesting kind of thing. I think in our culture, we oftentimes think about freedom as like the freedom to. Like the freedom to wear a mask or not a mask. You know, the freedom to carry an arm. The freedom to, you know, whatever it might be. And in Buddhism, it's the opposite. It's the freedom from. It's freedom from the bondage of suffering, the dependence of a lot of these things we have the freedom to do. We actually need freedom from. And I love this because I think because of our fear, this is just totally me ranting, so please tune out this part if you need to. But I think sometimes like religions have kind of over history of like been really afraid of our free will. You know, like I have the freedom too, I want the freedom too, but we don't really trust that freedom. And so we impose all of these kind of commandments and these like purity rules and these things and you know, create all these systems around how people should act. Okay, sorry about my political rant for a second. But I think it's empowering. That's what I'm trying to say is like, you know, to see that like, yeah, I have the freedom to choose, you know. I have the freedom of removing myself from the dependence and the habit as well. All right, the third important criteria is, does my indulgence in this behavior, this habit, or this pursuit cause harm for other people? And that's important as well. You know, does it benefit the welfare, my welfare and happiness, and the welfare and happiness of others? It's a both and. You know? Because I know some of us, I know sometimes myself, it's like I'm also so fixated on other people that I'm not looking at how my habits affect me as well. You know, I'm so fixated on making sure other people are okay, you know, that I'm not really looking at myself too. So we've got to do both. We've got to really look at both, internal and external, self and other. The Buddha says that renunciation ultimately leads to joy. They call it the joy of renunciation. And when we start trying to tackle a habit, we've usually known for a while that it hasn't been serving us. And it doesn't seem so joyful in trying to practice letting it go, does it? You know, and the Buddha even says this in one of his teachings. His attendant, someone named Ananda, some of you all know Ananda, was asked by a group of lay people, non-monks, and they were like, hey, y'all have given up a lot to be monks and nuns, and we see how you're glowing with this kind of radiant joy, and we don't really, our heart doesn't really leap up at renunciation. Like, we're not really pumped about giving up our shit. And the Buddha just normalized it. He was like, you know, basically, I've been in the same place, you know, like early on in my path, my heart didn't leap up at letting go of stuff. He said, but then I started to do it. You know, the gift of desperation unfolded and I started to have to give up. And the first thing I gave up was the comfort of my home and this privileged upbringing. And I went out into meditative practice. And as I did that, this deeper type of peace and happiness started to develop. And then I had this verified faith, this confidence that renunciation leads to this type of higher happiness, of not having a happiness from what I can get from the world, but how I meet the world. And when I started to see that, my heart now leaps up at renunciation. Right? They have a word for this in positive psychology called the virtuous cycle, that once you do something and you feel the benefit of that, your heart and mind desire to do more of it. And they talk about that with habit formation, right? Like we start to break away from a destructive habit and we feel that relief. You know, once you get over the hump, that like withdrawal period, and you're like, oh my gosh, what was I doing in that relationship for all those years? Or what was I doing, you know, with that behavior for all those years, that kind of feeling of relief. And they call that the joy of renunciation. So I won't talk a lot about this, but outer forms of renunciation is looking at our kind of behaviors. That's a good place to start. It's a rather hard place to start because we don't maybe yet have an understanding, like a seeing for ourselves, like a readiness to change a behavior. But my experience has been that I'm often not ever fully ready to change a habit. You know, and I've been a therapist for years, and people come in, they're like, yeah, I just don't think I'm ready yet. And I'm like, yeah, I don't think that people really get ready to change a behavior that they're dependent on, that's still serving them in some ways. You know what I mean? So what we do in Buddhism is we try to just practice around these training precepts. I'm not going to go through them because Rachel talked about them last week, if you were here. But we try to practice not intentionally causing harm with our behaviors. We try to practice only taking things that are freely offered. We try to practice being wise and careful with our sexual energy. We try to practice being wise and careful in our speech. We try to refrain from being dishonest and manipulative and divisive in our speech. And we try to practice heedfulness around our consumption of things, in particular intoxicants. And renunciation is sometimes at this level of looking at our relationship to these five things: what we take, how we cause harm, our sexual energy, our speech, and our consumption. Those are five really great categories of looking at, you know, where maybe some suffering might be in our life. And then there's this inner renunciation, right? It's about, remember that I said it's not about the thing, it's about the relationship. So it's about really, what is our motivation in our habits, right? What's keeping us connected and glued to them? And remember this non-identification of not taking it personally, but taking responsibility. Like, it's okay to look at this stuff. I'm not this horrible monster. I'm not that unique. You know what I mean? It's also one of the gifts I feel like I've gotten being in recovery is like I did some horrid shit when I was in active addiction. Crack cocaine and methamphetamine will make you do that. And I've been around people that have done some horrible stuff. And I'm not proud of it, you know, but like we helped each other heal through that. I've been clean for 15 years and some people have been clean for 20 years and 30 years. And it's a miracle that anyone can get clean a day when there's that much shame and guilt. And are we better people for shaming ourselves into a death sentence? No. And there's a story of Angulimala where there's this serial murderer that killed, I don't know how many people, was it 1,000 people? Yeah. Chopped their fingers off and wore them on a necklace. He's trying to kill the Buddha, and the Buddha, he couldn't catch the Buddha. And the Buddha just finally turned around and he said, "Stop it." That was the teaching. Stop it. And sometimes that firm, loving, like, dude, you are causing suffering. Like, of course you're killing people, but like, you're just suffering. Everyone's suffering around you, and stop it. So this inner practice is, you know, sometimes that gentle, firm, stop it. We gotta stop it. And sometimes we don't realize the habit until after we've done it. And Martine Batchelor talks about these kind of four stages. I won't go into them in depth, but I think it's helpful. It's like she talks about the after. Like after you've already done the habit is a good time to kind of reflect. How does that feel? In Buddhism, regret is a healthy emotion. They call it one of the guardians of the universe. It's a great thing that we feel that feeling. But what happens is we quickly, without knowing it, we turn it into shame. It's the difference that from like, oh, this feels bad, to, oh, I'm a bad person. That's what we mean by over-identification. So then we can't even feel the healthiness of the regret because we're so busy and self-loathing about it that we can't even take responsibility. So shame is just such a deterrent to us even changing. You know what I mean? We have to just be like, oh, that sucks. That's a great thing. And sometimes we experience that in the after. And then sometimes in the beginning, or sorry, the during the behavior, like we're doing it. Like texting with the ex, right? Or like doing the thing that I'm trying, like drinking the coffee. And sometimes we kind of wake up in that moment. It's like, oh, I'm doing it. Like, what is the mind like right now? How does this feel? We get that understanding, that experiential wisdom. Sometimes we catch it in the beginning. It's like right as we're starting to do it. Right? Have you ever had that experience? You're like on your way to do something. I had many times in early recovery on my way to the liquor store. It's like, oh, fuck it, I'm going to do it. And then I get there and it's like, fortunately, that awareness. I'd spent so much time after having gone to the liquor store reflecting. And during reflecting, I started to catch the beginning. I was like, okay, that's progress, right? And then eventually we can get to maybe the before, right? That before we ever even pick it up or do it. You can notice that craving arise in your body, that feeling. And when we talk about letting it go, we don't mean pushing it away. We actually mean let the craving go. Let it arise. And if we don't act on it, it will pass on its own time. You know, that's what I like to think about with letting go, is letting it go through its cycle of life. We don't have to listen. We don't have to act. Some of my thoughts about renunciation. And just to close, Ajahn Chah, let go a little, get a little freedom. Let go a lot, get a lot of freedom. Let go completely, complete freedom.